All right. So before the evening gets away from me slash us, I just wanted to say to all of you, this has been the favorite class that I've ever led or facilitated for me. I mean, in all the years that I've been here, people are here for what they're here for, and it's just all perfect. Those first hours have been so profound and just life-changing and uplifting. And I'm sorry now, I have to say, that we didn't record it. We didn't, thinking that maybe people would be inhibited or because it's so personal in some ways. But with hindsight, I don't think anybody would have been. And so when we offer this again in 2 years, please come back and tell your next round of stories. It was really, for me, I'm not expecting it of anybody else, but it's been an extraordinary 4 weeks. And we were up in Seattle a couple weeks ago sharing with all the people in our Seattle community about this new curriculum and thinking of ways to bring it into play. And we were talking about this class, and now they have one on their schedule, and then the Village heard, and they have one on their schedule. So I thought tonight, I better write them and tell them that that first hour is so critical. But the whole class is. So I thought tonight that I would tie up what I thought were a few loose ends. They may only be loose ends in my mind. So if so, forgive me, but we'll hear it again, and that'll be fine. Just probably talk maybe until about 8:30. Some of that can include, there'll be time for questions. And then Lahari has a slideshow that she's going to show. And then we have one more experience that Lahari will lead us in tonight. So I wanted to just step back just a little bit. Lahari spoke last week about Carmen reincarnation. And of course, we've spoken each week that we've talked about Carmen reincarnation because it's just virtually impossible to speak about death and dying for us on our path with these teachings without talking about it. And I said to you that first week, having been born and raised Jewish, where there is never any talk of that, so much of the early part of my life that was filled with experiences of death, I've just had this thing in this life where I've been around. I'm around a lot of death and a lot of automobile accidents. It's just something that's happened for me. Watching people get to that moment of passing and having no idea what to do with it, it's so deeply sad. And I realize it with hindsight more than I understood it as a child. But now, of course, decades later and lifetimes later for me, and I imagine for a lot of you, that we have another way of holding all of this so that we can now finally really make some sense of it, although it's not sense, but even have the beginning. And I know some of you in this class are struggling more with this than others, and I know that because a lot of the questions that aren't being asked in class are being asked later in private, fair enough. But, you know, just, and I get it. I mean, as I said earlier, we grow up this whole life, no matter who we are, even as yogis, the early part of this life is, you know, the death is still so taboo. And I've spoken to a few Indian people because, interestingly, there have been a few people who were born in India who have sort of wandered in and out of this class. A couple of people here were the first class or two and then didn't come back. But I asked them, because my experience in India, and I've been there a good amount, is that death is definitely more accepted. It's not as big a deal, and people die, and they're cremated, and even kids go down to the cremation sites, and that's what happens. But I said, nobody talks about it, right? And everybody said, no. So you still suffer huge losses. And it's not like because you were born in India and not here that it's less traumatic as a child if your mother leaves or your father leaves or your grandparents who you've lived near or, but still people don't talk about it. The acceptance is there, and I think that makes a big difference. What I heard from Uma earlier, for instance, I don't necessarily think she could speak that way because she's Indian. She speaks that way because she's that highly of an evolved soul, and that's who she's become, but not because she's been helped through this. But I wanted to just step back for 1 minute to this notion of karma and reincarnation. And I know most of you, as I look around the room, know this, but I want to say it again, first of all, for people who don't, and also so that as we end this class, we can hold this whole notion of death and dying in this light. And that is not hard to remember at all, that although we are deluded with the fact that what's going through this life is this body and all of the experiences, emotional mostly, and physical and material, that we have in life, really what's happening is that life is a spiritual experience. It's an experience of and for the soul. And I know we know that here, but it's important to hold that right now. Whether people know that or not doesn't make it any more or less true. It remains the truth, whether people are aware of it, that it's an experience for the soul. And that soul comes in kind of with a predetermined set of experiences that it's going to have. It will find them, it will create them, it will make it happen. It can't help it. The soul is energy. Energy is magnetic. It draws to itself exactly what it needs from this previous lifetimes, which for us just feel like a dream when we talk about it. But it's really just this continuing experience for the soul. So we come in, no mistake who we come into, no mistake if our parents are brutal alcoholics or if they're the most loving beings in the world, or if our younger sister dies when she's 3 and that's a challenging experience, or if we have the best older brother in the world, if we're successful in our life, if we're not, there cannot be an experience in life or in death ever that is not exactly perfect for us. And we call that karma and reincarnation. That is the soul. And I said this in the first week, I know I did, that's like in this astral spine where it's kind of taken up residence, if you will. That's not exactly how it is, but it's close enough for how we're talking right now. And it's like memory foam. It just comes in with all of these indentations and little bits of magnetic energy here and there. And the more we can remember moment by moment that it is all perfect exactly for us. It wouldn't be perfect for any other soul on earth. You know, this Sunday I'm giving the service, and honestly I have not thought much about my talk, but the talk is, I glanced at it, you know, that saying from the Bible that says, don't cast pearls before swine. I mean, it's all, for me, it was always just the hardest reading, but after years on the path, I don't feel that way. But really what it's saying is you cannot teach somebody else. Certainly you can't force somebody else. And if you come this Sunday, forgive me, how am I not going to say this again? I'll have to say it because it's what it is. You cannot teach somebody else by your karma. And you can't teach them at any point in time in life. This is why we say, very simply, we always say, oh, everybody just needs to learn from their own experience. Well, of course they do. Absolutely. There are no two astral spines that look anything alike. Like our fingerprints, which are manifestations of that energy anyway. The astral spine was there first. Of course our fingerprints don't look alike. Of course our cells don't, even though they all have similarities. Do you know what I'm saying? So even right up to these experiences that we have, whether it's near death, whether it's a little bit of post-traumatic stress syndrome, because we went through so much at one time and we either almost died or we did die. You know, again, I told you I've never been quite sure why anybody calls it near death. It's death. People die, they leave their body, then they come back and they talk about it. They died and they came back, so it's a bit of a misnomer. And if you can actually And, you know, and this is interesting because you're all sitting there and shaking your heads, yes. But if we really know this, just this, and we remember it, death takes on a whole other meaning. It doesn't take on the meaning of crushing loss, whether it's our own or somebody else's. It can no longer be, very much like what Sarah was saying before, just sad, just a loss. You know, that's why I stopped to tell you that story of the Ramayana, because to those souls, death was so freeing. They said, oh no, we have to incarnate again. We have to get into a body again. We do not want that. So their guardian angel says, I'll tell you what, I'll make it easy. You live for 3 months and I'll have your mother, the beautiful great queen, drown you. So on life, it just looks terrible. Why did my father drop dead when he was 39 years old and had 4 little kids? Why did my sister die when she was 42? You know, why did my brothers lose a leg, each of them? Why did they have heart attacks? 5 between the two of them. You know, you could look at all of this and go, why me? Why me? Why them? Why people? Why death? Why life? But as soon as you buy karma and reincarnation, you just can't hold it that way anymore. You have to at least try on that the death and dying process, we should say dying and death. I don't know how it ever got to be death and dying, but the dying and then the death is a situation where the soul is free to go on and do what it needs to do next. And, you know, I can't remember, just because I'm not living at home yet, I'm just about to move back into my house in a few days, but I can't pull up some of these stories and papers, and I can't remember if I mentioned this the first week, but when my mother died, I don't remember when it was, and it doesn't matter, I mean, exactly what year. She died, she was 72. By then I was smart enough to know that wasn't that old. Now it's right around my corner. But anyway, she died at the age of 72. And a friend wrote me the most beautiful, she gave me a poem, which I just may email to all of you at some point. I'm so sorry I haven't brought this in because I can't quote it, but I think I told you, but it's about the ship. And first the poem describes the experience of watching the ship leave and as the ship's aiming towards the horizon. And everybody's sort of on shore saying, oh, there she goes. You know, and it's the sadness of letting go. But then the poet turns it around and talks about people on the other side of the world and on the other side of that horizon who say, ah, here she comes. And it's such a beautiful instance of what Master and Swamiji have talked about. We grieve when people leave this world, but in the next world, call it what you will, they're celebrating. This great soul has joined us, and I know some of us have felt it. But I wanted to say very distinctly and very concretely that whenever we go to think of death and dying next, we have to hold it like this. We have to keep saying to ourselves, don't think of the confinement of this body. Doesn't mean we're not going to miss people. Of course we're going to miss people because most of us don't have that ability yet to stay in touch the way we'd like to stay in touch. Though it was very impressive hearing story after story of the way so many of you have felt deeply connected to people who have left. And as we were talking earlier, for those of you who weren't here, this sense of freedom of the soul that we talked about, several people said that after somebody died, they felt so much closer to them. They were able to feel closer, not the constraints and restrictions of personality, of family feuds, of likes and dislikes in the heart. All of that vanishes at the level of the soul. And I said then, and I just want to repeat it for everyone, when Swami Kriyananda passed, the night he passed, there were so many stories. They literally made a website so that people could tell their stories. You could probably still go to ananda.org and find it. because Swamiji appeared to so many people. That night, that moment, as he was leaving his body, and the stories, I remember we had one of our, Davy and I co-lead a women's group up at the village. We usually do it every year, though we skipped this year because of my surgery. And so Swamiji died in April, and then the group was in June. Were you there that year?
Not that one.
Not that one. And there were two people who told, one of the women told the most amazing story. I don't think I can get it right, so I don't want to misquote it here. But of the clarity of the visitation of Swamiji and people who really barely knew him. Now, that's Swamiji, and I don't like to only tell stories about the great saints because it's easy to put it on a shelf and think it just happened because they're a great saint, but it's not true. And we've heard a lot of those stories in these weeks. So I'm offering right now in this final class to say to everybody, try and hold this differently. Try and remind yourself. This is a delusion. This is what it means when we say that we live in this great Leela, this great play of God, this great light show of lights and shadows, that nothing that we see is real. All those words that they really mean so little. They don't define the spiritual experience. But this class defined it. This class of people telling story after story of being there when a soul leaves. You know, when I was in my, I guess it's my third year of medical school, and we started having clinical experiences. Until then, you're mostly in the classroom. A little bit you're not, but you're not taking care of all comers in the hospital, that's for sure. You know, you have to wait till you get your third year and you still don't know anything and you're taking care of all comers now that I think of it. But I had already been a nurse for 14 years. And I had done most of my nursing career in ICU, coronary care units, emergency rooms. I was really very hospital, intensive care hospital based. So I was completely at home in hospitals. And I was completely at home with people dying, because that's what happens in intensive cares and coronary care units and whatnot, emergency rooms certainly. And that whole third year, I didn't know any of what we're talking about now, really. I mean, I want to say that. I didn't have the words for it at all. But my friends in medical school would come and get me. Really, literally, this is true. Whenever one of their patients was going to die, because most of them were 22, 23. They just had never seen anybody die. But I had seen a lot of people die, and I was comfortable with it. And the thing that became the most clear, and everything I'm saying right now, I'm saying for a reason, because we're talking about us holding it differently. We're talking about what can we do at the moment of, you know, what are some of those things that we can do? And I remember right where I am in my story, but I already told you when my sister was passing and I said to my entire family, no, you don't stay away, but you don't grab her and hug her and talk to her in a loud voice, because there's an exquisite sensitivity. And I'll bet, and nobody really spoke about this, but I'll bet anybody who's been there when somebody's passing would speak of it. They're operating in a different realm. So if you think the thought, if you put the energy into a thought rather than crystallizing in the form of words, that person who's passing receives it. If you open your heart and you go to just embrace somebody with all of your heart's love, they feel it like the quintessential hug. Do you know what I'm saying? But if you hold their body like this when they're really in that in-between space, it feels terrible. They are moving towards less confinement, less physical reality. So what I realized, when every time I was called to the bedside by these third-year medical students who were kids, you know, I was many years older than them, and they would say to me, I don't know what to do. So honestly, first, many times I would help them put in an IV so that we could give comfort meds if we need. Just literally give somebody something to help them breathe a little easier or for pain. But very often, they thought I was going to do something with the person who was leaving. And very often what I did was with the people who were staying. And I would talk to them right in the room. This is what's happening. Are you okay? Can you tell your father you're okay? Can you breathe? Take some deep breaths. Then when everybody would get calm and realize what was happening and was in a bit of an uplifted state over and over and over, that person would leave their body. Because the soul knew what it was doing. But it just waits. We were having a discussion before about who dies when we're there, who waits till we leave, who does what. My sister needed me to be right in her bed with her. And I told you the first week, she kept seeing where she was going. She would just look at me very nonchalantly and she'd say, come with me. And I'd say to her, no, sweetie, I can't, but look how beautiful. Oh yeah, it's beautiful, I see that, but I'd like you to come, she'd say. I mean, it was precious, you know, and it's just like that, like the soul is on its way there, and that soul will make a choice. And these are just personal stories. They don't matter so much, but they're, they're instructive is the only reason I'm sharing them now. When my stepfather, who I was so close with by the end of his life, and I kept saying, Dad, I'm coming again this Friday, I'm coming Friday. Okay, sweetie, I'm here. Thursday morning, he left. And I think I told you this, but when they called me at home at 5 in the morning, and the nurse who called me said, your father died, I said to her, are you sure? It's like I was questioning her. I couldn't believe he left before I got there. But then later I realized he would only leave when I wasn't there. He could never have left if I was there. He, at a soul level, knew that. He was so attached to me. And so all of this, there's such, at the level of super consciousness, which is how we're trying to hold this, there is so much going on that we can't know about when we're here living with attachments, restrictions, needs, the heart's likes, dislikes. We all do. It's not like I want to say that in a critical way. We all have it. But the soul knows much more about what it's doing. And I think we should try and remember that and just honor that and step back and up and say, this is happening at a soul level. What is it? Which is part of where that kind of intuition comes from that Uma mentioned to us in the first hour, that for 5 days, did you say, Uma? Or a week or something, or longer. Before her father died, suddenly of a heart attack, he was perfectly well, but that she knew she was having an experience of death. And it was just so poignant because she didn't know who or what, or she just knew. And really, with God's grace, she stayed calm about it and was waiting to see what was happening. But that's a super conscious experience. That's what that is. That's what our goal is to not be dealing here, because it's the nature of the ego, the soul, when it's identified with the body, to want to hold on. It's the worst divine joke in the world that the soul comes in and gets identified with the body. And then the soul itself is attached. I mean, it's a little challenging. So every single thing we do, and this is why we say all the time, and we can't overemphasize this, that as much as possible in all of life, everywhere, and at the moment of death, that we keep our attention and our energy at the point between the eyebrow. We don't have to know the right thing to say. We don't have to be brilliant about the right thing to do. You close your eyes. You bring your attention here, where our thoughts are, where our concentration is, where our energy is, our consciousness follows. So just by focusing our attention here, we lift everything, we at least allow for the possibility of a superconscious experience. And that's how we help people die. That's really what we do as we help souls pass. We hold it in the experience that they're having. So let me stop for just a minute and ask for questions or comments. You know, that's a very good question. Swamiji is asking us if there's research done on people with Alzheimer's who are passing, where is their consciousness, I think is really. And, you know, I've been asked that question several times, and I should have an answer for it, but I don't. I don't know that there can be research, per se, because I think we'd have to find what master or some master said about it.
Yeah.
Because the research techniques are not going to tell us what's happening at the level that you're asking the question. But I hope to remember to look that up in master's teachings. I think only a great soul, could answer that question. Yes, that's a very important comment. Navishan's talking about the astral ascension. And it's interesting, we were going to actually read it here, but I don't think we wound up doing that. Did we do it when Connie? No, she was going to. You know, we owe you all a copy of the astral ascension as well, because it is a beautiful ceremony that speaks to the soul. And at one point it says, to the soul, and what of those of us who are still here? What of us who are still here? I don't have it in front of me, but... So it speaks to the soul, and it speaks to us in the way that Swami Kriyananda would when he wrote it, which is almost an affirmation. Here's what we're doing. Here's where we are. And it's remarkably uplifting, even to people who know nothing about this path. So it's a very important comment. And I would say to each of you what would be easiest is if you want a copy of that, because anybody can read it anywhere. Connie herself kept reading it to, I believe it was her father, over and over as he was leaving. And I think she said that in her class. I would send you the electronic version of it, but please write to me, because otherwise I'm afraid it may never happen. Any other questions or comments? You know, just to say to you, it's a good question you're asking. It's a very big question. So there's a lot of issues about that. Bethany's saying the soul reaches it has done as much spiritual growing as it can in this lifetime. It leaves that body when it reincarnates. Does it mean it's coming in to have other experiences, and did you say continue growing?
Yeah.
Well, that's the best case scenario. You know, that's what I mean, and I don't mean that to be as glib, but it's true, is that our souls continue to evolve into their true nature, and that each lifetime is a forward, upward, expansive progression of that. And that is the best case scenario. But, you know, there's several thoughts that I want to say. People don't necessarily make a huge amount of spiritual progress in every life. And, in fact, people can lose ground in a lifetime. It happens that people actually move backwards in terms of spiritual progression. And Master Swamiji said it's not often that once you've attained a human level that you have to be born again as an animal or even worse. But Master says it's happened. So we are responsible for living every moment of this life in the very best way that we can spiritually. Not that we set goals that we have to achieve or it's been a failure, but that we look for superconscious solutions to as many of life's issues as we can. That we are consciously thinking of raising energy, that we're solving problems in the direction of God. As Haridas once said, everybody needs to be a spy dog, solving problems in the direction of God as much as we can. because it really matters. You know, it's not like we all go to the same place when we leave here. There are these things called locus. I mean, there are really lots of different astral places. I mean, for lack of a better word, but souls go to different places. And a lot of it has to do with not just how we've lived this life, but this is an amazing thought, and that is that Master said the very last thought in our mind is the most important thought in terms of where we go, where the soul goes next. And not just next in the moment, but its next incarnation. So, and I said this to you, I think 4 weeks ago, when Swamiji went back to him and said he was lamenting so many things in his life. And Master just said, oh, I wish he wouldn't have done that. A soul that was getting ready to leave. I mean, he just, you could feel the sadness even as the story is related. You know, it's when you think of these things on a practical level, I had a seclusion about several years ago. I don't really remember which one it was. But it came to me that I was carrying a lot about people that I've hurt in this life. And that I've had moments in my life. It happened to me around the year 2000, I remember, where I got so obsessed with the things that I had done wrong that I was making lists. I went back to when I was 4 years old, when I told a lie to my mother, you know, and when my father died and I was 14 and nobody was telling my grandmother the truth, his mother. You know, they didn't want to tell her the truth, and I just burst into the room and said, they're lying to you, Daddy died, you know, and I just sort of, because I thought it was so awful that everybody was lying to her, but I really hurt a lot of people with that. Anyway, stories like that, like kids do things. And then as I went through my life, things that adults do that can injure people, lies that I've told, people that I've hurt. And several years ago, 3, 4, maybe, I realized you cannot keep doing this. You cannot keep saying to yourself, that was bad, that was bad, that was bad. You have to really genuinely let it go. It doesn't mean that you go, oh, it's no big deal. You have to learn from your lessons, but you can't be attached to them, or it's still such strong ego attachment. So I spent an entire seclusion making amends with people, really, apologizing. I mean, not in fact, but in my mind, going through those people and telling them genuinely how sorry I was, but that I was going to put it down now, and how much, and I loved them, and I prayed for them, and I wished them well that they could heal from some of the ways that I had injured them. It was so freeing for me. I could quit blaming myself. And not at that moment of passing, like what happened with this man, be still lamenting it. Because otherwise, it's so ego-involved in a way. We think we're being good by suffering, but we're not. It's just the next way we focus on ourselves. So to be able to let go of those things. You know, one of the most meaningful experiences, I think Lahari said something about this last week too, was when I happened to be around when Jyotish was diagnosed with his bladder cancer. Jyotish, who's the spiritual successor of Swamiji, and I know many of you have heard this story, but it's important. It's an important story, and I'm going to abbreviate it to make this point that we need to make in death and dying and karma and reincarnation. When Jyotish was diagnosed with bladder cancer, it was right at the beginning of a spiritual renewal week, 3 years ago. It was right after it must have been four years ago. It was before Swamiji passed, so it was 4 years ago. And I just got to be around him. I call it grace now, as he went through those first, I mean, many people were up there. It was not me singularly, but anyway, I was there. And I watched him receive that karma. Oh, bladder cancer. Okay? He says to me very calmly the first morning when we were talking, what's the worst that could happen to me, Shanti? I said, Jyotish, I don't know. I mean, I didn't want to say anything to him. I don't know what kind of a cancer. We don't know anything yet. Given all bladder cancers, what's the worst thing that could happen to me? I said, you could die. He said, okay, what's the next worst thing? Just like this. At no point was he glib about it. It was his cancer. He knew it was his cancer. He owned it. He earned every bit of the treatment, which was not so easy. He wasn't in denial about it, but he wasn't attached. It was like just getting into the river, you know, oh, I'm supposed to get into this boat now and do this, and I'll ride down the river. And when the ride's over, I'll just get off and the river will keep flowing. Nothing got stuck. He wasn't afraid of the cancer. He wasn't opposed to the cancer. He didn't necessarily love the cancer. He was beyond likes and dislikes with it. And I watched that karma just flow through him. It was one of the most spiritually instructive moments in my life. And it really helped me through my surgery. I just kept thinking of Jyotish every day. And I wrote him and told him because, I mean, it's a surgery. It's not a cancer. But as I've said to you all, the truth is I got really sick and it was miserable. I mean, that's just the truth. It did not feel like, oh, this is nothing. But that's not how Jyotish was holding it either. It's not that it's nothing. It's with much more respect than that. This is my karma. This is what I need to live through. Yes, I hurt these people. That's the truth. But I am not going to carry that into the next life if I can help it. So this whole letting go and consciously thinking of what it means to help other people let go. What do we do when people come to us to apologize for some way that they've behaved with us? What do we do when they come wanting to make amends? Do you know what I'm saying? I mean, every little bit of energy that we could glom onto, the more we let go and the more we let go, the more we are, the closer we are to experiencing freedom of the soul when it leaves this body, the more we're helping that soul leave in a meaningful way. Questions? Comments? We'll stop in a few minutes so that Lahari can talk and do what she needs to do. Uma? Yeah, I just want to repeat it out loud because it's so beautiful what you're saying. But I mean, just two things I'd like to say. One is that willingness to follow our intuition, to see it and to know it and believe in it. Maybe we need to sit and meditate on it. There's a lot we need to do because not only was there not so much reason to go, like you said, it's just tourism, why would I go? There was a lot of reason not to go. It's hard to leave a daughter who's not yet a year. But then what you said, that if we stay conscious about also seeking joy, not just resisting pain. And I'm just trying to remember an experience, but I can't draw it back to where it was. But somebody else just said to me exactly what you're saying. They were trying to decide whether to go somewhere or not. And they said to me, you know, if somebody was sick or dying, I would go. Why don't I go now? Whatever it was, which is really what you were saying. So, I mean, good for you for knowing that and to make time for joy, which we so often seem to feel less deserving of or less aware of. Yeah. And then you got to live knowing that you had that. That's wonderful. Very good.
These teachings.
Yeah. Yeah, these teachings that... Yeah, that's why... these teachings are extraordinary, and you're right. And there is such a cultural, it's interesting to hear it about India too, this cultural tendency to want to mourn and grieve and wail. I mean, yeah, and wailing is, it's a huge thing with Jewish people. I mean, somebody dies, that's what you do. It's a sign of just how horrible it is, how deeply touched you are, how much you're grieving. And yet, it's wonderful to feel so steeped in the teachings. I'm mostly repeating this so that it's on this video. Well, I think more what's being said is at that moment, she was beyond feeling a need to behave like other people behaved. I don't think if we feel sad about somebody's passing that that's not spiritual or not, you know, it'll happen. I think the attachment to the sadness is much more of a dangerous, and it sounds subtle, but it's not. I just take 2 minutes and then to say, I don't really know what most people or what Master would say about coma. I think my sister looked like she was in a coma for 7 days, but she and I were definitely communicating. Not the other doctors thought I was crazy. They knew I was a Stanford doc. That's the only reason why they didn't commit me. But they put a lot of value on that. But I know where she was. And Master says all the time, which is about chanting Om in the right ear, that the hearing is the last sense to go, which is why Lahari said that with Julia, that they knew to chant into the right ear. I don't think that we should ever assume, this is not Master now, this is me, that we should ever assume that because somebody is in a coma, that anything is necessarily different in terms of how we would behave. I don't. It gets into a lot of questions that I'm not prepared to talk about, and I don't know the answers to, like, when do you take somebody off of life-sustaining measures? You know, what can we trust about pupils being fixed and dilated and thinking people are gone, quote-unquote, brain dead? Very complex stuff. But I think if somebody's breathing and in a coma and they have a heart rate, I think from a spiritual perspective, we should treat them as if that soul is there and treat them exactly as we've been talking about, helping somebody either stay or go or whatever it looks like is trying to happen. Yeah. I know that's not a perfect and long enough answer, but it's, yeah. Okay, so...